Welcome to Cosmophonia. I'm Meredith.
And I'm Gabe.
And today we're talking about the piece, The Narrow Path,
by Stuart Saunders Smith.
So you may have noticed, depending on where you live, that there's a solar eclipse coming up.
Yes, and it is in the spirit of that eclipse, we will say retroactively that we have gotten a little off the cycle of the moon. Sorry.
Yeah, turns out we're not very good at that, but at least we bring you content on a somewhat consistent basis.
It's true, and we have been actually deeply embroiled in eclipse related goings on here.
Yes.
So there's at least half a dozen events that one of us has had some involvement with.
Mm-hmm. As the resident space music people, turns out there is an occasion to call upon us, and that is this.
Yes. Who knew?
Who knew? Well, we did know.
We knew
because turns out solar eclipses are very easy to predict, and people have known about when they're coming about for a very long time, and because of that, we knew,
mm-hmm.
and we're like, it's coming through here. This was like over a year ago that we started thinking about this and being like, yeah, we should make sure something happens.
Yes, and it took eons for the rest of our community here to get with the program, but they did, and that's the important part.
Yes.
And one of the things that we have been talking about and planning is a recital of eclipse related music. We'll put a link. You'll be able to live stream it.
Yes.
We'll put a link somewhere. It'll be the night before the eclipse, so the evening of April 7th at 8. So a long time ago we started gathering up ideas about not just how to do, because there are a lot of concerts happening with space music,
mm-hmm.
But not the majority, I think, are actually doing a lot of eclipse music, mm-hmm. or even necessarily like sun and moon music. There's a lot of Here Comes the Sun going around.
Yeah. Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yeah.
Kind of on topic.
Yeah. But like we, your friends, the Cosmophonia hosts, have understood that there is actually an awful lot of genuine eclipse music, and we decided that that's what we wanted to fill this concert with.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several pieces that we learned about that we ultimately could not include for mm-hmm. various reasons.
There's a piece called Eclipse by Toru Takamitsu, but we weren't able to find people to play the instruments.
Yes, it turns out that here in southern Indiana, there are not a whole lot of virtuoso shakuhachi and biwa performers fluent in the language of contemporary classical music.
Yeah.
So that was one that we couldn't do. And there was another one that just logistically and difficulty-wise, we didn't have the resources to put together. And that's what we wanted to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a piece called The Narrow Path by a mostly percussion composer named Stuart Saunders Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we kind of got taken by this piece because I don't really know why it's called The Narrow Path. There's no program notes in the score or that I can find online as to why it's called this, but it seems super relevant to the idea of eclipses because it really does require a very narrow path in which the moon appears to entirely cover the sun. So,
yeah, so, and I forgot, I think I found this piece by just browsing the university library, mm-hmm. and I searched for the term, I think, align or alignment, and this piece came up, and I said, oh, man, this is so perfect because of exactly that reason. The hypothesis, I think the working hypothesis that we have is that the narrow path deals with this idea of alignment.
Mm-hmm.
So we should tell you a few little facts about this piece.
Right. It's a piece for three percussionists, two vibraphones and 1 orchestra bells.
And the bells are just very high sounding.
They are very high sounding.
Very twinkle.
Mm-hmm.
There's a quirk to the way the parts interact with one another, which is that they are not designed to align perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few, but really just a few passages where the instruments are supposed to line up.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of it, each part is rhythmically very, very different from the other two.
Yeah.
And the composer, he even kind of alludes to this idea that they will drift apart from one another. So if you tried to line up the way it's notated in practice, that's not how it will actually happen.
Right. And so his solution to that is pretty clever, actually. The piece is constructed of, 20-something events. And each of them are kind of bracketed off in all of the parts. And he specifies that some of them have a little fermata, which is a piece of notation that tells you to pause. And he says that once you get to this fermata, you're supposed to just wait until everyone's done, because he presumes that you've got a little off, because the rhythmic notation is extremely complex. And it's really more about the effect rather than counting everything perfectly, right?
Yeah, because almost every measure is in a different meter. The rhythms that fill each measure they involve all of... It's just really hard. Trust us, it's just really hard. We were listening a little bit ago, and I was following the second vibraphone part.
And I was following the orchestra bells because they were piercing out of the score. But that still wasn't enough. I got super lost.
Yeah, very easy to get very lost. Which is part of why we couldn't put this piece on the recital, because that freedom of being able to drift apart from one another, though, it sounds like that should simplify life because you don't have to be very precise. But that's sort of an illusion. It's really... there's enough that does need to go together, and you do need to maintain a sense of awareness of the other parts. So it actually would take an awful lot of practice over a long period of time to really fully understand how each of the parts interacts with the others and feel confident that you're not, you know, in section 18 when everyone else is in section 7.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's... I feel like this is something that's really common with percussion ensemble pieces that are very... they're very rhythmically complex, or they tend to be. Like, I remember I played on my friend Sarah's master's recital, and one of the pieces on her recital was a piece for 2 pianos and 2 percussionists, and it was so hard. Like, it was so hard. And it wasn't just because the piano part was, like, super fast, but it was, like, putting all of these intricate rhythms together. The piece was called Textures, which is totally appropriate because it's not necessarily a melody and a harmony, it's a texture, and it's all about kind of exploring texture. And this one's kind of similar. It's not like there's a melody exactly.
Yeah, and the idea of it being an exploration, I think, also makes sense because it's not a short piece.
No.
I mean, as you might guess, because of all of this rhythmic uncertainty, it is not exactly of a set duration overall.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the performances that we found, they're between 15 and 18 minutes. So it's a lot of understanding how these three instruments can make sound together, especially in the ways that they can not align or sort of align. Like, there's some really beautiful moments that stick out where maybe 2 or even 3 of the instruments play the same notes or chords, but they get offset by each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of hear these echoes between one and the other. And there are my favorite are the parts where you don't expect it, but at least two or three of the parts are told that they need to play in unison with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, there's not just a shift in the texture, but also really a shift in the timbre as you hear these kind of unison vibraphones.
Yeah, exactly. That one, it sounds a lot more structured than the rest. It doesn't have a whole lot of different pitches, and it kind of is in a little melody, and suddenly you feel like, oh, okay, I feel a little grounded here. And that part actually comes back twice. So once it comes back the second time after all this other kind of, it's not random, obviously, it's written out, but like, you might get a little lost in the weeds and be like, what's happening? And then suddenly this part comes back and you're like, oh yeah, that part again.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the really beautiful aspects of the piece as a whole. You know, it is long, it is mostly pretty slow.
Mm-hmm.
And the pitches, the language of it is complicated, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not exactly tonal. But we'll come back to that, I think, because there's something interesting about that. But it kind of gives the impression that you could be sitting there listening to 15 minutes of just sort of atonal, misaligned shimmer sounds. but the fact is that from out of that, I think if you give the piece a chance and really just sort of sit and listen, then those very, very special moments of alignment come out.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a little, I was struck by them, not confused exactly, but you notice that it's different. It's mm-hmm. conspicuously different.
Yeah, which maybe is why it's called The Narrow Path and explores these ideas of alignment, similar to when events such as the solar eclipse happen, because the rest of the time, the movement of all the celestial bodies in the sky, like, obviously they are not random because you can calculate them all, but if you're not paying attention, if you're not counting, if you're not calculating, it's just like, oh, they're all just kind of doing their own thing. And until suddenly this, like, out of the blue alignment happens, and it seems like such a moment. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And there was one of the events that I recently did was a kind of outreach event in rural Indiana here, and I was talking to a gentleman afterwards who said he kind of had this question about how we know the eclipse is going to happen with great precision, but he was kind of marveling at how when you look up at the sky in the weeks or months beforehand, there's no indication that makes it really obvious that a total solar eclipse is about to happen. And I mean, there's an almost one. We had during the last full moon was a penumbral lunar eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
And that should make sense because all of the bodies are like pretty damn close to being perfectly aligned. But, you know, not exactly. Mm-hmm. And a penumbral lunar eclipse, if you've ever tried to see one, it's, I don't want to talk down on penumbral lunar eclipses, but they're really kind of unimpressive because the moon passes through like the weakest part of the Earth's shadow. So it looks like a little grayer than normal. You wouldn't really notice that it was happening unless you were looking for it. But I kind of love the idea that a dramatic eclipse like the one we're about to experience, that makes you cognizant of the coincidence of cosmic alignment.
Mm-hmm.
But that really, it does kind of come out of nowhere. I mean, yeah, sure, intellectually we might understand that, yes, it will happen at this time precisely on this date. But, yeah, you know, going about your lives, I don't know.
Yeah, it's not like... You know, for a few days leading up to the total eclipse, there's like a little eclipse each time. It like gets bigger each day.
Wouldn't that be cute if the last like five new moons were just a little bit more?
Yeah. That too. But no.
Nope. All at once. Mm. And then all the birds freak out. They don't know either.
They don't know. Yeah. In fact, Didn't we get, like, an email being, like, download this app to, like, report what the birds are doing?
Well, yeah, there was because there's a lot of interest in how wildlife responds to eclipses.
Mm-hmm.
NASA and other agencies and research groups, they want people to go out and record what the birds do. And this is connected to just a general lack, like, we know some things, but we want to know more about how animals react to eclipses. But apparently part of it is that in the past they've detected that some birds will not only react specifically to an eclipse, but that individual birds in the same species will react differently, which is amazing because it means that each individual bird is having its own little moment, just like we will.
Yeah.
And what kind of an incredible way to get insight into bird talk, right?
Yeah.
Wait for something truly extraordinary, even to birds.
Yeah.
And see what they, and see what kind of language they come up with in response.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you could go for many bird generations and none of them will have ever experienced a solar eclipse.
Right, right. Well, and I wonder if the birds in Carbondale that got to experience the last eclipse will say similar things. I'm sure some of them, sure plenty of those birds are still around.
Yeah, true, true. Is it going to be total in Carbondale again?
Yeah, they get it twice.
They get it twice. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Lucky.
Carbondale, Illinois.
That's the place to be for the past 7 years.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, we've gotten a little astray from the narrow path.
That's okay. We're going to come back together, like at the end of the event.
Hey, we're just enacting.
We are. This is a verbal enactment of the piece.
Yeah. I did want to say one. I mentioned this thing about the tonality, and I'll, apropos of nothing, I'll just say it now. There are two sections of the piece where there is absolute strict alignment between all of the parts, and it's the very beginning and it's the very end. And in both of those sections, it's really sort of this, it's very, very simple. And it's very, that simplicity is very, very fascinating. Because in both sections, it's just a series of chords that are barely even chords. It's mostly just like an open 12th. A C and a G, and I mean with some doubling in the higher octaves. So this is like the most consonant possible sound there could possibly be, and it's the most perfectly aligned thing. It's notated like it has to be perfectly aligned. So you hear the most simple consonant structure that you could possibly engineer as the bookends to this kind of impossible to comprehend landscape where there are lots of accidentals and weird rhythms. And I found it really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I wonder how you're supposed to react to that opening. Are you supposed to like be like, we've left that behind? Or are you supposed to think like, that's just kind of going in the background?
Well, what did you think?
I don't know. What did I think? You know, I think part of me expected it to come back. Like, cyclical. I don't know. Maybe I just have, like, the unanswered question on the brain. Because, like, that piece, it's not the same at all, but there are some similarities. It has this, like, really simple kind of chordal thing happening in the strings. And then there's this, like, increasingly complex and discordant human music as opposed to the celestial music. But then it always goes back into that celestial music, you know? The craziness ends because it can't compete. But this doesn't sound crazy. It's really very tranquil, even though it's very complex at the same time. You know, it kind of just has this floating kind of quality, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of that is also attributable to the dynamics in the piece, which the composer doesn't actually write out for the vast majority. He left a note that the performers are supposed to compose out the dynamics themselves beforehand. They're not supposed to improvise it. They're supposed to plan for themselves the dynamic profiles. And most of the performances that we found online, there's basically two, but most of them, they opt for staying on the quiet side of things, but you end up getting this kind of a lot of relief between them. So quiet bells, quiet percussion, misalignments, but like And I, you know, I say it's like it kind of gets a little atonal, but it's really not. I don't find it off-putting or well, I like atonal music, but like I find it actually a fairly approachable. You know, there's dissonances, but they're gentle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then it's still such a contrast with those bookends, which are relatively short also in comparison to the whole.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, since it is just a kind of steady repetition of that sonority, and it's very slow, like they're held out for a very long time, if you don't know when it's over, you're not going to know when it's over, because it's like, are they going to do it again? Or is that the last time? Like, there's this one performance I listened to where they, like, had an extra long pause in between the second to last and the last chord, and I was like, oh, it's over, and then bong. Guess not. Now is it over? I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of thought of it as maybe a little different from what you were describing. I thought about it as a little bit outside the rest of the piece, because I was trying to imagine being a performer and coming on stage and saying, okay, we're going to do this thing. So you've got these, you know, in the beginning, it's five articulations that you're going to do all together. And it's like saying, okay, we made it to the stage. This part's easy.
Yeah.
We just we'll listen to each other, we'll pay attention, and then off we go. And then when it comes back, it's sort of like, all right,
we're done.
We did it.
We did it.
Let's confirm that we did it.
Yeah. I always like it when a piece ends like pretty easily, because then you're like, oh, whew, I got through all the hard parts, and now I can just do dun 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 dun. I'm thinking of an actual piece that I am participating in on our concert.
I had a feeling, yes. Is it the medley of 19th century Eclipse tunes you have on the brain?
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
For the next Eclipse, we can talk about those.
Okay.
There is this.
When is that going to be?
20 years.
All right.
You heard it here. Cosmophonia 2044.
All right.
Well, so there's a question. There's this alignment business. That seems eclipsy. The path, that's eclipsy as well.
Mm-hmm.
I feel this piece contains some other celestial markers.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah. Like what?
Like the instruments involved.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I mean, sometimes when I think of like, what is a spacey sounding instrument? Like the first thing that comes to mind is usually not percussion, but there is like the twinkly aspect of these, you know, struck instruments that does sound kind of spacey and makes you think of stars twinkling or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if this is over analysis or a very niche interpretation, but so stars are sufficiently small and sufficiently distant that with the exception of the sun and Betelgeuse, none of them can be resolved in a telescope like as actual two-dimensional surfaces, right? So all stars through all telescopes, basically, they're what you call a point source, right? They appear optically to be infinitesimally small. So when you look at like a Hubble image and there's stars on it and you see them, they look like different sizes. That's actually the optics reacting to the brightness of the star, not the actual size of the star.
Right.
So I kind of love that when you hear these metallophones, when you hear them struck, to me, they kind of conjure this idea of point sources in the sky, because there's just this moment of attack. And then depending on how you attack it, then it'll sustain for a different length of time. But they kind of feel like point sources to me.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I think that's totally right. And it makes me think of this other piece by John Cage called Atlas Eclipticalis. And it's a really weird looking piece. I have the score of it and it's hard to figure out what you're supposed to do. But essentially he took a star chart and he just traced over all the stars in it. And then he was like, here it is, it's the score. And then he assigned like certain instruments and instrument groups to each of the dots. And I think it is the, you know, the size of each object tells you how loud you're supposed to play. So that's kind of interesting, like translating, you know, brightness of star to largeness and then largeness of star to loudness. Yeah.
And that piece also traffics in alignment issues.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, because the parts don't line up either. Oh. You kind of even less than in this piece.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, both of these composers are really into kind of adding aleatoric aspects in their pieces where the performers have to make some decisions. Like, I think I'm pretty sure that Smith does this a lot, like what he does with the dynamics in this piece, where he's like, you have to compose it. You know, he leaves some stuff up to the performers to co-compose with him the piece, which is an interesting approach.
When you put it that way, it actually really makes me appreciate how he's done it in this case. I've written some music with aleatoric bits, and sometimes it works fine. Usually it works okay. But I think it's kind of nice to give the directive to the performers, like, no, you will have to make decisions, but you have the time and the opportunity to think about them in advance, and that's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And there's no wrong answer. So, you know, just think about it, how you want to be expressive with it, and then do that thing.
Yeah. I wonder if that's hard for, like, classically trained performers, because I know when I was a piano major back in college, I was not taught to improvise or, like, really make up my own music at all. It was all, like, how do I play what's on the page? Yeah. In a technically proficient manner, you know?
Yeah, I think it's very hard. I mean, he helps them out by not making them invent any pitches or rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that the performers have to co-compose is the dynamics. But I think even that is still difficult. I am still really bad at notating dynamics. It's like, I know it's a personal weakness in my craft. And so I'm always tempted to just throw up my arms and be like, let them figure it out. They know how to be expressive. But as I tell my students all the time, like, no, you have to put something on the page, because musicians train to be experts in interpreting what is on the page,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not that they don't have imagination. It's the opposite. They have it's tremendous imagination in understanding when this piece calls for me to play softly at this moment, like, why and what does that really mean,
mm-hmm.
which is a different kind of analytic and expressive operation than say, oh, I feel like it should be soft here, right? And that's what, which is what Smith is asking people to do.
I mean, I guess I was trained to do things like add dynamics to Baroque pieces, like Bach piano or keyboard pieces. Like, he didn't write in dynamics because they were written for harpsichord. You can't really have dynamics on the harpsichord unless you have multiple pedals or manuals or whatever. But still, depending on who you ask, there's, like, ways you can do it and ways you really can't do it. Like, I find that really funny when it comes to playing old music. Like, I was playing this piece by Couperin from the early 18th century at a department house concert last summer, and I played it on the piano because that was what was there, and somebody was like, wow, I've never heard that piece played on piano before. And I was like, really? I mean, it was written for harpsichord, but, like, you can play it on whatever instrument you want, technically. And I also find that funny because, like, back in the day, people just played on whatever instrument they had. I mean, it was becoming more common to, like, write for specific instruments. But still, it's like a modern kind of idea that you have to do it a certain way, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I like when performers feel empowered to take some expressive ownership in their work. Right? I love it. That's like my most favorite thing, when people play Mozart and they improvise, even if it's, and you know, any kind, if it's, even if it's just the little ornaments, or maybe if they do add some twiddles or some flair at a little, at a cadence or something.
Mm.
I love that, because that's, first of all, Mozart, I'm picking on Mozart now, but like, Mozart would never have played any of his music the way it was actually notated, right?
Yeah.
He would have always done something based on his mood, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, over the course of the 19th century, things became more hyper-notated, and certainly into the 20th century, there became this idea that what the composer writes down is gospel, yeah. and, you know, you must obey it. I think a piece like this one, it works to undo that a little bit by putting more creative control back in the hands of the performers in a way that's, you know, acknowledges that it's difficult by saying it's just dynamics. That's all you have to worry about.
Yeah.
And percussion is like dynamics, so it makes a lot of sense.
mm-hmm.
Especially the classically trained ones. They don't want to just, like, beat the shit out of their drums. They want to, like, actually be... they want to make music. That's a nice challenge.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Does this count as space music if the composer didn't say it was?
Well, we turned it into it, didn't
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ha.
Ha. Take that. Well, I don't know. I think we're entitled to, you know, it's non-specific, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, this is a podcast about music in space, not about space music.
Ah, there you go.
I've never been in a total solar eclipse before. Yeah, although my first day of PhD was a partial.
Oh, that was the first day?
Very first day.
Wow, that's an auspicious...
It was very auspicious.
...beginning.
Yeah, although they say that eclipses are supposed to be bad omens in astrology.
Mm.
Actually, yesterday I was trying to write program notes for our concert, and I was looking up whether Hildegard von Bingen ever wrote anything about eclipses. Because she wrote about, you know, cosmology and all kinds of stuff. The only thing I could find, she wrote about lunar eclipses.
Oh, that's
And here's what she said. She said, lunar eclipses are caused by conflict and storms among the elements. And they temporarily cloud out the moon. But the moon is stronger than the storm, so it always comes back.
Oh. I wonder if that logic would apply to the solar eclipses as well.
I don't know. I wonder if she knew about them.
Surely. Because people knew about solar eclipses.
Yeah, but she didn't say... I mean, it was a book in Latin, so I was having difficulty going through it. but I looked through, like, it was Causae et Curae that I was looking at, and the first part is all about... cosmology and stuff, and she only said stuff about lunar eclipses as far as I could tell.
Well, I wonder if it would be different because her interpretation of the sun was not a parallel to her interpretation of the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the sun symbolized very different things from the moon.
Hmm.
Well, if any of you out there know, send us a note. Let us know. Actually, if any of you are Hildegard von Bingen scholars, then we definitely do want to know. We like Hildegard.
Yes.
She'll be opening this recital.
Yep.
Yes. And with another piece that is almost definitely not actually an eclipse piece, but...
No.
but it's about...
Virgins.
Well... and the light is about light. So...
Yeah.
Eclipses are as much about darkness as they are about light, I think.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So Mariah Mitchell, the first professional female astronomer, after taking her students to see the 1869 eclipse, wrote this account of it. And in it, she's describing the whole thing. And after totality is over, she says something like, nature rejoiced in the light, we rejoiced in the light, and we felt that we loved the light. And I like that sentiment that, you know, totality is awesome or whatever, but then the sun comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah. The moon continues on its narrow path.